This is Terrence McNally. This conversation with George Packer was recorded before the death of George Floyd. As it makes clear, we were already living in a failed state, the tinderbox within which we watched Floyd be murdered.
Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with George Packer, author of The Unwinding and the Richard Holbrooke biography, Our Man. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, and I reached out, actually, after two of his recent essays got my attention. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. And this is the point where I plug participation. Needless to say, this is an election year. I encourage you to get involved not only with candidate campaigns, but also with efforts to fight voter suppression and assure that all Americans get to exercise their right to vote as if the future depends on it, which it does. This year, that may mean doing whatever you can make sure that mail-in absentee ballots are available to people in your state and all around the country. And now as we confront the coronavirus pandemic, I also encourage you to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, and also by finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation now unfolding. Support your local community businesses. And now to today's conversation. My latest podcast featured a conversation with activist, author, filmmaker Astra Taylor about her documentary, What is Democracy?, and her companion book, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. And very near the opening of the film, we're reminded of Plato's challenge. Why democracy, he felt, would inevitably lead to tyranny. The rich will always want to get richer. This leads to extremes of wealth and poverty. And the poor will follow any demagogue who promises to overthrow the rich, leading to tyranny. That was Plato, okay? The last time I talked with George Packer was in 2013 about the people and the ideas in his book, The Unwinding. And that was 3 years before the Electoral College victory of Donald Trump. The book reported and reflected on the America that was fertile ground for that to happen. And that I want to lay this out for you. That book, The Unwinding, begins with these words. No one can say when the unwinding began, when the coil that held Americans together in its secure and sometimes stifling grip first gave way. Like any great change, the unwinding began at countless times, in countless ways. And at some moment, the country, always the same country, crossed a line of history and became irretrievably different. If you were born around 1960 or afterward, you have spent your adult life in the vertigo of that unwinding. And Packer goes on to argue that seismic economic shifts during a single generation have created a country of winners and losers, leaving the social contract in pieces and setting citizens adrift to find new paths forward. In 2013, Packer sees America as a superpower in danger of coming apart at the seams, its elites no longer elite, its institutions no longer relevant. And in the 7 years since, accelerated in the 3 years of Trump and accelerated dizzyingly by the pandemic, that danger has arrived. This spring, George Packer has written two essays for The Atlantic that were the ones, as I said, that led me to reach out for this conversation. The first, The President is Winning His War on American Institutions, was published about the time the NBA was calling off its season. It's a deep look into the successful dismantling and corruption of the federal government by Trump, the Senate, and Bill Barr, which left us in some unprecedented ways especially vulnerable to the pandemic. The second, reporting on our response to COVID-19, is titled, We Are Living in a Failed State. In my intro to that 2013 conversation, I observed that the late evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould described humans as the primate who tells stories. He points out that civilizations have existed for millennia without the wheel, but as far as we know, no society exists without stories. The Unwinding and those essays, all of Packer's books, are built of stories and narratives. The first lines of The Unwinding I read about, the coil that had held society together, that's all narrative. And there is the narrative from the unwinding through the election to the essays and to the tatters that we now see of our national spirit, our public health, our economy, and our confidence. I say a story has a beginning, middle, and end, but a narrative has a past, present, and future. And where does this narrative go next? George and I will also talk about last year's Pulitzer finalist, Our Man, Richard Holbrooke and the End of the American Century, which is out in paperback this week. The book is a powerful narrative and character study of a figure that I don't think could exist in our current government. George Packer is a staff writer at The Atlantic and the author of The Unwinding, An Inner History of New America, winner of the 2013 National Book Award, The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, a finalist for the 2006 Pulitzer Prize, Blood of the Liberals, winner of the 2001 Robert F. Kennedy Book Award, last year's Our Man, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer, winner of the Hitchens Prize, and the LA Times Prize for Biography. And as I said, it's out this week in paperback. George is also the author of a couple of novels and a play, and editor of a two-volume edition of The Essays of George Orwell, a reference I find very apt these days. Welcome, George Packer, to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work.
It's so good to be with you again after 7 years, Terrence.
Yeah. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Friday, May 22nd. First of all, how are you doing? Where do you live? What's the pandemic like where you are? How are you coping?
Well, we're in a little town a couple hours north of New York City, so we're not at ground zero of the pandemic. My kids and wife and I are hunkered down here with our dog. And, you know, we are very lucky that we can breathe fresh air and get fresh food. The biggest challenge is keeping everybody's morale up and keeping the family, on civilized terms, which we're succeeding in doing. But my wife said, you know, our patriotic duty is to be tolerable to other family members. And that is one of the that's one of the tasks. There are others too that we are burdened with.
Yeah.
So we're doing fine. And
okay. Now your state yeah. has certainly had, you know, has been the epicenter and now seems to be among the first two or three that have flattened the curve.
Yeah. I mean, New York City and surrounding suburbs was and is the worst hit part of the country. Maybe you might say of the world. I'm not certain about
Perhaps,
that.
Perhaps, yeah.
And there was a period in April, I was talking to an emergency room doctor in Brooklyn, and late March when it just wasn't at all clear that the hospitals were going to be able to handle the incredible suffering coming to their door. That seems to have leveled off, as you say, and these hospitals have survived it. A lot of people have not. A lot of people are sick, and then there's just the devastating economic consequence. Just mentioning to you that a whole bunch of my colleagues at The Atlantic were just laid off, 68 of them. And that's just a tiny little piece of the general picture of despair and disaster that's hit us. It's just mind-boggling that, 2.5 months ago, very, very few of us were even thinking about this. Only the most sort of far-sighted or best informed. I got to admit, I wasn't thinking particularly clearly until my wife started saying, why are we riding the subway? Why are we, this is maybe not a good idea. Why are the kids still going to school? And now the world has changed so quickly and dramatically. It's like nothing we've ever lived through, I don't think.
Yeah, it's funny you remind me. One thing I do when I'm not doing these interviews is I help organizations with their storytelling and their narratives. And I had an engagement to work with a group of business folks. And I'm forgetting exactly what the date was, but about 2 weeks before, I called the person I was doing it for and I said, are you thinking of rescheduling or thinking of doing it virtually? And he said, no, I've talked to people, we're good. And a week later, I said, you know what? I don't want to do it. I don't want to come in and spend 3 hours with people that I don't know where they've been. 2 days later, the organization canceled it, you know?
Well, this, Terrence, was a period, those first couple of weeks of March, which I'll never forget, when ordinary people had to make their own decisions. Because nothing, well, we should talk about this later when we get to the Atlantic essay, but nothing was coming from the authorities. It was silence, or worse than silence, it was distractions and lies. So people had to make these judgments with very little information based on hunches and anxieties. And that reminded me in a weird way of countries I've reported in,
sure,
where there's no government to look to in a time of crisis. That's what it felt like, and still does to some extent.
And I'm in California, you're in New York. We're both in states where governors ably picked up the slack, but that's not the same. And there is a lag before they realize that's what they had to do.
That's right. I think you could fault Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio for being slow, especially, I think, Mayor de Blasio. But once Governor Cuomo realized what was coming, he acted very quickly and started holding these daily press conferences that became like must viewing and told us the truth, which we have not been hearing from the federal government. And as you said, without a national response, all these local improvisations are just treading water, just desperately trying to patch something together. But it's not going to suffice because this thing is so much bigger than a town or a state or even a country.
Okay, now one thing I'm going to jump on right away, George, just because otherwise I know I'll forget it before we get to the end, which is that, as I said in the intro, you edited a two-volume edition of the Essays of George Orwell. I confess I'm not nearly as well-read in Orwell as I should be, but for you to have spent that much time with his essays, what are some of the words or ideas that have leapt out at you over the last few years from Orwell? We'll just set that at the top here.
Well, I have to say, I mean, Orwell was like my MFA program. In my 20s, I just read straight through all of his work, especially his essays, his nonfiction, and really kind of apprenticed myself to it, learned something about writing by reading him passionately and carefully, because he's such a clear thinker and powerful writer. So, I mean, the most obvious, and it's the thing most people take from Orwell, is how easy it is for power to get inside people's heads and make it impossible for them to see reality clearly. And that's especially true, obviously, in an authoritarian regime, but it's also true in a democracy where either advertising or social media or the, you know, the malignant narcissist in the White House can take root in our minds, and the power we think we have to think independently, to hold on to facts, to, you know, remember that 2 + 2 = 4 is shockingly fragile. And can be twisted or flooded or numbed into submission. And so that's, I think that is the most basic message you get from Orwell's best known work, whether it's the novel 1984 or his great essay, Politics and the English Language. There's a whole lot else in Orwell that I love, and mostly it's just his ability to convey experience concretely, honestly, totally unvarnished, without making you cynical, while keeping your eye on moral values that are fragile, but that you just can't let go of, or else you'll be lost. So he's seen it all, he faced it all: Nazism, communism, imperialism, unemployment, poverty, all of it, and did not lose his sense of decency and of what matters in human life. Even simple things like He has an essay called Some Thoughts on the Common Toad, which is a beautiful essay about the coming of spring and how important it is not to lose sight of that while you're, you know, horrified by the day's news. So that's, I guess that's, for me, what's essential about Orwell is just the insistence on truth and clarity and good prose while not making you want to kill yourself.
Yeah, very good. I'm glad we touched on that. I'm going to talk just a little bit at the top here about the unwinding, because as I said, I think it supplies us the context in which everything else happened. There's an interesting form to the unwinding. As I mentioned, you've written novels and a play and so on, and the unwinding has stories, it has vignettes, it has... How did you settle on that form?
The unwinding began with the financial crisis and the Great Recession and the election of Obama. And I just knew that interesting things were happening in parts of the country that tend to get overlooked by the elite media. I spent a lot of time in Youngstown, Ohio. I spent a lot of time in Western North Carolina, where there had been tobacco and textiles. I spent a lot of time in the exurbs of Tampa Bay. I did not have a single unifying story. I had all these threads, but together, you know, I had maybe six characters in these different places, each of them kind of embodying some aspect of our society, each of them with their own individual struggle, and all of them of roughly my age. So it became a kind of generational portrait of America, going back to the 70s and forward to the Great Recession. And how do you do that in a book? Well, I finally realized that the answer was a novel. And that novel was the USA trilogy of John Dos Passos from the early 20th century, where he follows half a dozen or more fictional characters as they make their way through the first three decades of the 20th century. But he also has these short portraits, vignettes, of the famous people who shaped the era, whether it's Woodrow Wilson or Isadora Duncan or Frank Lloyd Wright. And I got that idea from Dos Passos to do the same for our era. So I have Newt Gingrich, I have Oprah and Jay-Z and Robert Rubin and Raymond Carver. And it sounds like a mishmash, but I hope what a reader gets from it is a kind of sweeping but really intimate narrative that shows you what's happened to the social contract in the last 30 or 40 years and how it's come undone, how it's first frayed and then really began to rip apart with the Great Recession, and what the effect of that has been on ordinary people. Because the heart of the book is these five or six people you've never heard of who I spend a lot of time with.
That's right. The celebrities get vignettes, sort of mini bios, but these characters, these Americans, are the thread that runs throughout the book. I'm going to read a quote from that book and then ask you a question. I'm angry at what's happened to our country and what it's done to a lot of Americans. I'm angry at the elites who have proved so self-interested and short-sighted that time and again they've led us to disaster. To some extent, the elites in the book are constantly building their own empires at the expense of an idea of community. And let me remind people again, this was 2013, 7 years ago. So you speak about being angry. You also...
That, by the way, Terrence, I should say, that's not in the book. That's about the book, because in the book, there's no I. It's all third person. And that was part of the form I chose, was to have there be no narrator, obvious narrator, but to have it move from character to character, sort of through their point of view.
Very good. Person. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for that. But there's also, I think, in addition to anger, there's shame in this book. And let me just mention a couple of things that, because I want to talk about the shame narrative. Two of the interviews I've done recently, Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn, in their recent book, Tightrope, they put a lot of stock in the shaming narrative that you should be able to do what is actually physically impossible, which is pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. And they indict that narrative as underpinning so much of what's gone wrong in terms of action, but it's rooted in that narrative. So a little bit about anger and shame and those narratives.
There's an undercurrent of anger and shame, not shaming, except maybe shaming Newt Gingrich,
right,
who to me stands for everything that has gone wrong in our politics. I think he is the emblematic figure of the last 40 years, more than Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. It's Newt Gingrich who poisoned the well and made it so that you could win by poisoning the well. He's sort of an antecedent to Trump that way. But anger, yeah, there's an undercurrent. It's not explicit. This is not a book that raves and fulminates. It doesn't have a narrator who is shaking his fist at you. It's got instead these lives. But the lives, they're not pure victims. You know, these are all people who have contributed in some way to their own difficulties and who also are fighting hard and are resilient and would not want to see themselves as victims. And that bootstrap cliche, which is deeply American, you know, it has its hold on these people too, to some extent. For example, Dean Price, who is one of the main characters, he's a biodiesel entrepreneur from the tobacco country in North Carolina. He's a farm boy turned kind of green economy evangelist. He wants to get rich, and his hero is Napoleon Hill, this rags to riches philosopher of the early 20th century. So he has no shame about making it and about thinking it's up to him to make it. But he also comes to realize that the odds are against him, and in some ways the game is rigged against him, because big oil and Walmart and the federal government are in some ways in cahoots against small businessmen like him. So it doesn't reject, the vision doesn't reject the American idea of aspiration and of upward mobility as a con, but it does show how hard it's become and how unfair it is to blame someone who may have made mistakes. They all make mistakes. There's bankruptcies, you know, there's children too soon, there's all kinds of mistakes, but nonetheless, these are people who basically are doing what they're supposed to do and cannot get ahead. They can barely keep their heads above water. And I met people like that all the time during those years when I was reporting The Unwinding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you write that there have been previous unwindings in U.S. history, and that, quote, each decline brought renewal. Each implosion released energy. Out of each unwinding came a new cohesion. Now, in 2013, I remember I asked you if you saw that happening this time, and clearly in the intervening 7 years, it has not. What are your thoughts about that today?
Yeah, I don't know what I said in 2013, but I hope I had the foresight to say, no, I don't see anything changing the direction we're going in. And in fact, although Trump's election shocked me, it did not surprise me in a sense. Today, I don't quite know where we are, because we're in the middle of it. We're in the boiler room. But what I do know is that this pandemic has exposed all the ills that are apparent in the unwinding and have become more apparent since then, whether it's political corruption or economic inequality and just the fragmentation of the country along race and class and partisanship. It's exposed it as an underlying health condition that could kill us. And I have the sense that people have in this pause in our lives have woken up to that. It's almost impossible not to see it. And I hear a lot of talking that is encouraging about how do we come out of this better?
Mm-hmm.
Not how do we come out of this, but how do we come out of this better? I think the one period that might be a little bit analogous is it's complicated here, but the early 1900s and late 1800s? Was it similar time of Gilded Age and trusts, robber barons, mass immigration, a very discontented working class? And that led to the Progressive Era.
Yeah.
The reforms of the Progressive Era, which in turn achieve their fruition in the New Deal. We're in a weird position where we've been kind of moving through a period of economic growth, and suddenly we're in the Depression. So it's like a weird mix of the Gilded Age and the 30s. What kind of politics that produces, I cannot possibly say, but I think it's going to be interesting. I'm certain we're not going to simply go back to normal, which had become untenable.
That's right. That's right. And sadly, as we talked about then, and as the unwinding showed, that's what we tried to do after the 2008 crash, was go back to normal without correcting the endemic, systemic flaws that had led to it, and led to it hitting people so unequally.
I think that's right. There were reforms. There was the Dodd-Frank financial reform. There was Obamacare, both of which were steps in the right direction, neither of which went far enough. And that reflected maybe not just a weak effort or a not, you know, strong enough effort by the Obama administration, but also the incredible reaction to Obama that came with the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anyone who thought that the Great Recession was going to automatically produce the New Deal quickly learned, no, it's going to produce a conservative reaction in the form of the Tea Party, which was the biggest political response to the Great Recession. Will that happen again this time? You know, will the open it up movement that you see in some states lead to like a second Tea Party that sweeps across congressional races, et cetera? I don't think so. This time, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think we're in a different place.
I think the efforts will be made to do so, as we see even with the protest. I mean, the open up protests are very reminiscent of the Tea Party in that way. I think small minority acting, you know, but I don't. I think. And by the way, I share with you this notion that there's a possibility. There's hopeful possibility in a waking up taking place. And as you say, people saying, how do we come back better? But nothing is a foregone conclusion.
No, because first of all, the obstacles are so great. I mean, we both know that, and you are putting effort into combating voter suppression. The entire strategy of the Republican Party at this point in its history is to try to hold on to power with a smaller and smaller voting base. The party has completely doubled down on older, white, Christian, rural, small town Americans, which is just to hear me say it like that, that's a shrinking base. And yet, rather than expanding, they have doubled down on it. And that means their only way of holding on to power, which seems to be their entire reason for existing at this point, is to prevent people from voting.
Yeah.
And
minority
also,
rule.
Their minority
aim
rule.
Is minority rule.
Right. Whether it's through the Senate or the Electoral College or through state by state measures that actually make it harder to vote. And they've done that very well. And then gerrymandering and all the other ways in which democracy can be perverted. So one of the wakings up that's going on, I think, is a sense that our democracy itself, through money and through power games, has been kind of strangled and needs to be liberated again. And it's going to take an immense political effort to do that, because nothing is easy in this country. You know, power is divided, and we do have these minority checks that the Senate and the Electoral College seem to represent now.
Yeah, Yeah, absolutely. One of the questions that I was going to ask you, but I don't want to do it because we don't have time, but I'm going to lay it out there for listeners, is how different do we think things might have been if Obama and the Democrats had done two things differently? One was focus their organization that led to the 2008 election and great enormous turnout on winning the midterms, including down ballot, so they'd have been in control much more of the redistricting, and two, actually, done more to take the side of Main Street against Wall Street, perhaps even some, convictions of individuals and so on. And I don't want to take the time to go into that, but those are the two things.
No, I can do this really quickly.
Oh, go ahead.
I agree with you on both.
Yep. And could have been done. He had the majority at that point. Could have been done.
You know, in my new book, Our Man, I have a line about Obama, and I admire him immensely, by the way. I admire him as a man and as a president. But the line is, he was a technocrat disguised as a visionary.
Mm.
And the 2008 campaign was a visionary campaign. And you could almost see in his face at the end of that campaign that he knew he had raised expectations to a point where it was going to be almost impossible for him to fulfill them. And then I think the real Obama began to govern, and that man was moderate and careful and very much a proceduralist and a believer in democratic values and the rule of law, but not someone who was going to sweep the country along with him in a vision of big structural change, to quote someone who knows him well, Elizabeth Warren. So he was not quite the president that the candidate seemed to promise.
Yeah, no, I hadn't thought of it that way before, but yes, it's absolutely. It was a visionary campaign. We elected a visionary. The people felt that, and that was not who he turned out to be. And in some sense, he'll end up probably seeming more visionary now out of office than he did in it. And it's also sad. Mm. You referred to Our Man. Let's talk about that for a while. As I said, this book comes out this week, basically in paperback. It is a biography of Richard Holbrooke. Why did you choose to write that? Because let me just premise that by saying, I see the unwinding, the essays, kind of what we see as all part of, a narrative. And then Our Man seems like you chose to step out of that and look at him and look at what, well, I know part of it is that it's the passing of the, perhaps even the possibility of figures like him that I think was part of what led you to write. Go ahead.
I don't think it is so much of a departure. I think of it in some ways as the unwinding abroad.
Mm.
And Holbrooke as, first of all, his papers were offered to me by his widow, so I had this incredible trove of diaries and letters that gave me an unusually intimate picture of the life of someone who's pretty close to the center of power, from the Kennedy-Johnson years all the way to Obama. So that's pretty irresistible for a nonfiction writer. He himself is both maddening and mesmerizing. He's unlike any diplomat you've ever read about, because he's more like a politician with a nose for celebrity and for making a name and for making waves. He makes enemies everywhere he goes. He also has admirers everywhere he goes. So he's just this charismatic figure. And at the center of his career was the war in Bosnia, mm-hmm. which was a terrible tragedy of the 90s, and that he didn't single-handedly end, but I don't know that it would have ended without his relentless negotiating in 1995. So that was his claim to fame. The other reason I chose it is because his life lets me tell the story of what happened to the American empire and the American century. He was born in 1941, the year the phrase American century was coined by Henry Luce, and the year America entered World War II and really began our career as a global superpower. And his life ended in 2010 in Hillary Clinton's office at the State Department, where his aorta tore during a meeting. And that was a period, I think, when we were beginning to withdraw from that role of automatic leadership in the world. When Obama was trying to do it slowly and gracefully, what Trump has now done chaotically and destructively, which is to pull us back. Holbrooke stood for just the opposite, for America as the indispensable country, America as a leader of democracies, and as of the only country that could really prevent or solve the biggest problems around the world. We had to be involved, and he thought he had to be involved because that was what his ego demanded. So for all those reasons, it is a story of the rise and fall of this superpower through the life of this one extremely large-spirited and large-egoed man.
Yeah, it's funny because I recall now that in 2013, when we talked about the unwinding, I said, I looked, and most of your past work is on foreign policy, foreign affairs, and so on. And now you've taken this digression to domestic. So I see
Here's how I see it, Terrence. Yeah. My last four books, Blood of the Liberals, that's a three-generation family history that is really the story of liberalism during the 20th century. The Assassin's Gate, that's the war in Iraq. The Unwinding, that's the end of the social contract. Our Man, that's the rise and fall of the American century. I didn't plan it this way, but looking back, I can say those four books are an attempt to grapple with what's happened to America during my life and our lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I see that. Yeah. Back and forth. But it's all like, where do we play in this? Who are we? Who are we in this?
Exactly.
One thing you say, which really struck me, and you say it, I think, in maybe the first line of the prologue, is you say, I can't get his voice out of my head. Can you talk just a moment about that? Because I thought, that's something. You've spent years working on this book, and you can't get his voice out of your head.
Well, unlike The Unwinding, Our Man does have a first-person narrator, and it's right there in the first sentence. Holbrooke, yes, I knew him. That's the very beginning of the book. What I wanted with that narrative voice was to give the reader a very intimate connection to the story, as if the narrator is speaking directly to you and isn't even narrating a book, let alone a kind of monumental biography, but rather a yarn, spinning a yarn and telling it to you informally and casually, maybe over one very long night with a whole lot of bourbon being consumed. And so it has that novelistic feel like The Unwinding, except this time there's a first person narrator. And I don't see that narrator as quite me. That's not quite my voice. I feel like it's more, the narrator is a bit of an invention and a person who somehow knows the story of Holbrooke just by having witnessed it. You never find out how, and you never see the mechanics of journalism and biography. There's no interviews, there's no research. All of that is at the back in the notes, but the narrative itself, I tried very hard to stick to it as a yarn, as if someone who just knows the story is telling it to you, and therefore Holbrooke is kind of becomes this, I don't know, yeah, this character, like almost like a voiceover telling you the tale in a movie. That's how I wanted to bring the reader very close to this story, because otherwise it would be like every other political biography. And honestly, what's the point? Why bother?
Yeah, this is more, let me tell you about this guy.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And very much, I mean, we've said it already, but it very much is, I mean, there's a Shakespearean, obviously, quality to Holbrooke. Enormously flawed, enormously ambitious, and enormously accomplished, and just short of what he truly would have hoped to accomplish, kind of. As you say, he's just, our reviews often say, you know, just below that top tier, you know, of great men. It seems to me the country has just been looking, this will sound, but maybe looking at The Last Dance, the documentary, the 10-part documentary about Michael Jordan, which I don't know whether you saw any of, but...
I don't have cable where I am, so I have not been able to, but I've been told by like 10 friends that I've got to see it. And I'm a big Michael Jordan and NBA fan, so I'm going to see it when I can.
As am I. But there, you know, the story is, he was ruthless, he was a bully, he was impossible, he was a gambler, he didn't take social stands, but he was the greatest basketball player ever, and he won. And I thought some of that. And then if you apply that vision of flawed humans of great talent and great ambition, and you sort of, I think, make the point that if we are all flawed, and some of us are very ambitious, and perhaps you judge those people by what they were ambitious about. Is that fair?
I think that with Holbrook, you have someone whose flaws are spectacular. I mean, he was so unable to see himself that he did things that most socialized, housebroken people wouldn't do, just in order not to be thought a jerk. Like, you know, moving around the name cards at the dinner after a funeral so that he could sit next to the right person.
Oh my God.
Namely the widow, so that he could, you know, use the funeral to launch his next career move. That was the kind of thing Holbrook was doing all the time. And yet at the same time, he truly cared about people suffering around the world, especially in victims of war, victims of, you know, refugees, whether the South Vietnamese boat people, the Cambodian refugees, the Bosnians, the Pakistanis. He was more committed to doing something, just to getting things done, than almost anyone I've ever heard of in government service, because so many people are just there to essentially cover their ass and not get in trouble and serve out their time and move up. He wanted to move up, but he wanted to do things. So you have to admire him for that while being appalled by his behavior. And it is Shakespearean, because the thing that he couldn't see was himself. And that's the reason why he never reached the top, because he kept getting in his own way and pissing off the people or alienating the people who he needed in order to reach the top, which would have been the Secretary of State's job.
Yeah.
So there is it's a dramatic story, and it ends in the office he always wanted to occupy.
That's right. That's right. In the office of the Secretary of State,
yes.
As you pointed out before, in a meeting with Hillary Clinton, who gave him his last big assignment, and it was in pursuit of that his heart broke.
Right. The story is really three wars. He begins in Vietnam as a young Foreign Service officer in the Mekong Delta, right up close to the insurgency, seeing all the ways in which we were losing and telling the truth to his superiors. Bosnia is the high point where he comes into his own, and America really comes into its own as the only superpower left after the Cold War. It ends with Afghanistan, which is a kind of circling back to Vietnam, an unwinnable insurgency where Holbrooke is trying to use the lessons that he's learned over his career, especially in Vietnam, in order to negotiate a way out, and he can't do it. And one reason he can't is because he has made himself so unlikable to Barack Obama that Obama won't really give him a chance.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's nice. You gave us a jumping off point to get into the essays. And we're going to start with The President is Winning His War in American Institutions, which I downloaded on the 10th of March. This is from The Atlantic. So that's its period. Because you point out that Holbrooke was not satisfied to keep his head down and keep his job, and so on. He stuck his neck out because he wanted to accomplish things, and so on and so on. And it seems like that other way of being is part of what has allowed Trump and, as I point out, Barr and a few others to do much more damage than people expected, I think, even. A quote from early in that essay: when Donald Trump came into office, there was a sense that he would be outmatched by the vast government he had just inherited. After 3 years, the adults have all left the room, saying just about nothing on their way out to alert the country to the peril while Trump is still there. And then you quote James Baker, former general counsel of the FBI, who says that many government officials, including himself, they were convinced that they were either smarter or that they could hold their own against him. And Baker says they're fooling themselves. He's light years ahead of them. Take the ball.
Yeah, I think that one of the lasting legacies of the Trump years will be the damage done to the federal government, and especially to the civil service, which does serve the president and the executive, but really serves the Constitution and the people, and is supposed to be protected to some degree from politics so that it can do its job correctly. And what Trump has done through mafia tactics, one of the main figures in that piece is Andrew McCabe, mm-hmm. who was the deputy and then acting FBI director, and who was really the one who brought the investigation to Trump and made Trump the focus of what had been just a Russian counterintelligence investigation. It became an investigation of obstruction of justice. And that happened in the spring of 2017 after Comey was fired. And once McCabe did that, he knew that he was a marked man. And Trump started going after him and his wife, a doctor who had run for state office in Virginia and lost, in the most ruthless and no-holds-barred way, as if they were his mortal enemies, and made it impossible for people to serve in places like the Justice Department, the FBI, and now the State Department with the Ukraine story, without fearing that they would be the target of the president's vengeance if they did anything that went against his personal interests. They are not there to serve his personal interests. They're there to serve the administration and the country. And Trump has made it instead like a company he's taken over, and he's now weeding out any disloyal employees and putting sycophants and hacks into the key political positions. Barr turns out to be one of the most important. Pompeo is another. In order to make sure that there's going to be absolutely no resistance if Trump, for example, says, I am going to deny aid to the state of Michigan if they send mail-in ballot applications to all of their voters. He said that. I'm going to deny aid, which is a version of I'm going to deny aid to Ukraine.
That's right.
If it doesn't do what I want and dig up dirt on my political opponent. So
do us a favor, though.
Yes, do us a favor in Michigan. So it's as if he's taken what got him impeached, and because it didn't
That's right.
get him out of a job, he's now doing it domestically, anything to get reelected. Well, that's partly the result of his having turned the civil service and really much of the federal government into an arm of his own interest. And that's the story I tell in that piece, through the lives of a few people in justice and the State Department who tried to stand up to him in some way, and or who didn't and became accomplices.
That's
or
right.
even became his enablers, like William Barr,
yeah.
the Attorney General.
Yeah, let me just quote a scene. As I said, the essays also have narrative, and that's why you choose to focus on a few characters. But this is McCabe. Yeah, that must have been really tough, the president told his new FBI director over the phone, to lose, to be a loser, talking about his wife, McCabe's wife, who'd lost an election. As McCabe held the phone, his aides saw his face go tight. Trump was forcing him into the humiliating position of not being able to stand up for his wife. It was a kind of mafia move, asserting dominance, emotional blackmail. And McCabe says, he boxes you into a corner to try to get you to accept and embrace whatever bullshit he's selling. And if he can do that, then he knows you're with him. And it was that explicit transfer of mafia tactics to government that I think people just were not ready for. And then it is his wife, Jill McCabe, who says, there's a lot of people out there who are unwilling to stand up and do the right thing. They don't want to be the next Andrew McCabe. And at State, they don't want to be the next...
Marie Yovanovitch.
Exactly.
The ambassador to Ukraine. And there are people in the State Department. I use the transcripts of the impeachment hearings to tell the story that's not as well known of the mid-level people in the State Department mm-hmm. who either tried to protect Ambassador Yovanovitch from the attacks of the right-wing media, of Rudy Giuliani, and eventually of Trump, or who abandoned her. And some went one way, some went the other. But they had seen what happened to their colleagues at the Justice Department and at the FBI. They'd seen how the entire team involved in investigating the Russian subversion of our election were gone. They were all forced out. It was a purge of the top level of the FBI because they did what was right in order to protect our election. And the people at the State Department could only draw one lesson from that. If I stick my neck out too far, that's going to end up being me. And so a few people were brave enough to at least internally try to keep Mike Pompeo from yanking Yovanovitch from the embassy in Kiev. But others essentially said, if he's going to do it, we have to let it happen because we're not going to lay down our bodies for our colleagues in the Foreign Service. But
yeah,
what that does is...
They do
yeah,
as a,
what that does is it demoralizes everyone. Eventually, no one has the courage to do it.
That's right. It's the cost-benefit analysis. What are the chances that my sticking my neck out will actually matter, right? And
yep.
then, oh, if it's me against Trump, I'm going to lose. Why bother? I'll
yeah,
live
and,
to and, fight another day, maybe.
That's right. And some of the calculations are even more subtle, like, well, I'm not going to fight this battle. I can't win it. But if I just stick around long enough, I'll be able to push back just enough to hold on to the integrity of the State Department. Or whoever replaces me will be worse than me, so I can't leave. There are many reasons, and some of them are honorable, for not leaving, for sticking it out. But in the end, I think you almost inevitably become co-opted.
Yeah,
by Trump, because he won't stand for anything else.
Right. And as you point out, Erica Nuland, who you talk about in the State Department.
Justice, yeah.
In the Justice Department, I'm sorry. She ends up leaving after the domestic terrorist attack on a synagogue when she realizes she can no longer justify what she's in. And he's talking about, he's basically using Trump's language about invaders at the border and invaders and so on. And she realizes it's too much, but it took an awful lot for her to get to that point. Let's talk quickly about Barr. I remember when he was being confirmed, it was, oh, he's an adult. Well, it turns out he's not the Constitution's adult. Talk a bit about Barb. And even since you wrote that article was published April 21st. That was before he wanted to drop the case against Flynn. That was before more inspector generals' heads enrolled.
Yeah, and it was just at the moment when he was pushing for a lighter sentence for Roger Stone.
Mm-hmm.
So a whole lot of things were happening right when that piece came out that reinforce the message, which is that Barr had made himself almost entirely a political tool of the president, which is not what the modern attorney general's role is supposed to be. Ever since Watergate, attorneys general have at least tried to appear to be politically independent so that the White House can't tell them who to prosecute or who to go easy on, as in the case of Stone and Flynn. Barr instead hasn't cared about that appearance. In fact, he seems to relish flaunting it in the faces of his critics. And in the piece, I say there are maybe two or three key reasons that people should have known, because they're right there in Barr's history. One, he believes in executive power beyond anything that most constitutional scholars think is legitimate. Two, he's a partisan Republican and has been throughout his career. And three, he is a arch conservative Catholic who thinks that the secular age has been has destroyed America, and he wants to rebuild America as a religious polity, which I don't think is anywhere in the Constitution, but which is in Barr's belief system. And in Donald Trump, he may have found, by the supreme irony of divine providence, the least likely partner in re-Christianizing America. But he has taken his opportunity about as far as you can.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we could have a conversation on November 4th. See how far they were actually
if we're intact. Yeah, if we're intact.
And how successful they've been. Let's turn very quickly to we are living in a failed state in which all of the things we've been talking about, the ruptures of the nation in the unwinding, the erosion of the government under Trump and so on. And now we face a pandemic. And I'm just going to read a quick quote. When the virus came here, it found a country with serious underlying conditions and it exploited them ruthlessly. Chronic ills, a corrupt political class, a sclerotic bureaucracy, a heartless economy, a divided and distracted public had gone untreated for years. I'll read one other line, and then I just want you to take a couple of minutes to talk about what you see in that one. And the other is that the virus should have united Americans against a common threat, and with different leadership, it might have. So,
yes, because Trump's entire approach to the virus and to the presidency is to do what serves his own interest. And he has pursued a policy of division, attack, smear from the beginning. And he's done that throughout the pandemic and has tried to separate red from blue, the sinful cities that deserve their fate from the upright heartland. And the living from the dead, really, the survivors from those who weren't lucky. And some Republican governors have followed suit and turned mask wearing into a partisan symbol, and others have not. And the country itself seems to be learning some lessons about Trump and pulling away from the barrage of lies and idiocies that come out of the White House every day. The polling has been pretty constant that 2/3 or more of the country thinks that Trump's chaotic approach has been a failure, and that he is partly or largely to blame for the incredible level of death and suffering that's hit this country since March. So I see this, as we said at the start, as a like an alarm bell that's gone off, and it's brought some people to their senses, and they're seeing things that may not have been totally clear. At least that's my hope.
Yeah, and one of my thoughts just about Trump's performance is that he envies strong men, he fancies himself a strong man, but he is too lazy to actually take the responsibility. This was in some ways an enormous opportunity. He could have made the federal government his tool while it was saving, people, and come out of this, I think, with a landslide.
I think you're right.
It wasn't in his nature.
He could have been Viktor Orban of Hungary, for example, and just used it to, consolidate power and to destroy the opposition. I think he's too lazy. He's too incurious. And he's, in some ways, too narcissistic. It takes a certain long-range thinking to get to the point where you consolidate authoritarian power. It can't all be about you. It has to have some higher goal. Whereas Trump, it's all about what's good for me today and tomorrow. And so he's done, he has made so many mistakes. I think they are costing him politically. They're certainly going to cost him in the judgment of history. And they all come back to his character, and it just shows you how incredibly important it is to elect someone of good character. And it also shows you, if someone this lazy and incompetent has been able to do this much damage, our democracy is not as strong as I grew up thinking. And what might be possible with a better Trump?
Yes.
A more skillful Trump.
A younger, more able, more forward thinking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, the Holbrook bio, Our Man, is out in paperback this week, and the recent essays can be found at theatlantic.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or a world that just might work, all one word, a world that just might work.com. They're the same website. TerrenceMcNally.net is TerrenceMcNally.net. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement, tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, usually 8 or 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at TeMcNally@Mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and at most major podcast sites. You can find years of those podcasts at my site or at those sites, anytime, anywhere, available to you. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely, and thank you, George Packer. Keep up the good work.
It is totally my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Terrence.